Being human, do you ever wonder what makes us who we are? Our habits, preferences, or where we came from? We are expressing ourselves in thousands of ways every day through our choices. Let's have a conversation with people who are having interesting lives. My name is Alan Walker. I'm a doctor of chiropractic and a human being.
So I'd like to welcome everybody to Chiropractic Revolution and the podcast Being Human. And today we've got a great friend of mine, someone who I met recently on a course that I was actually on, someone who lives up in Scotland, up on the borders, someone who has six dogs. I'm always interested in dogs and people's animals, and is running several courses at the moment in this country and also in Europe. So I'd like to welcome on Donald Francis onto the Being Human podcast.
Thank you very much, Alan, for having me. I've been very excited about coming on since you mentioned it.
No, fantastic. So I'd like to know if it's okay with you, just a little bit about yourself, you know, your sort of background. I understand that you were military at one time.
Yeah, it seems like a long time ago. I actually left the army nearly 19 years ago, later this year. But it was a big part of my life. I joined the army at 17. And left at 32. So they're very formative years. I was an officer in the Royal Artillery. That means I was based in Germany. I did a long time in the UK. But over that time, I went to some places and did some exciting things. So, but it was a different me, in many respects, but it was a different human being that left compared to the chiropractor now.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's I've noticed is that you haven't got a great Scottish accent.
Yeah. No, I'm born in Zimbabwe. That's that little country north of South Africa. We think of ourselves as similar to South Africans, just a lot more classy. I've been in this country over 30 years, married to a Scot for 22 of those. Nearly 23, actually. We've been living in Scotland nearly 15 years. I left the army 2005 and went off to Palmer College of Chiropractic in America. Was there in America for 4 years and came back, and I opened up my practice, Tweed Chiropractic Clinic, here in the Scottish borders. I've got two practices, one in a town called Galla Shields and the another one in a town called Hoyk, which is spelled Haywick, and most people who don't live in Scotland really murder it. And I've had those two practices going now for 14 and 12 years respectively. I didn't associate, which I think was a mistake. I think I'd have been a lot busier in my own practice had I associated. But at the time, we did what we thought was best. But that's the way it goes. Nothing in the past can ever be changed.
So you're running a business with no associates, just CAs.
Yeah, I've got two associates, and we've got two more joining us over the next couple of months. We have at our busiest, we had four associates, but as anybody who has associates knows, associates come and associates go, and hopefully they learn, grow, and leave their own little legacy behind when they do.
Well, anyone who's working for you is going to be learning an awful lot. I understand that one of the ways that you work with chiropractic is you use the SOT or something similar. Do some cranial work?
Yeah. So is it? So I am a member of SOTA Europe, and I was on the board for 10 years or maybe 11 years. And I've done all their exams and courses, and I've taught for them for 6 years. I haven't taught for them since COVID, really. And I'm no longer active on their board or teaching staff, but that's another story. So part of how I practice is very SOT informed. You know, you can't spend so much time studying something without it really being part of your your functioning DNA. But I wouldn't like to be very closely associated with one specific technique, because if you came and watched me, you would see blocks and you would see me doing things which are familiar to an SOT practitioner, but there would be an awful lot that isn't familiar to an SOT practitioner. And I really would like to identify with and be more identified with the broader parish of chiropractic than any specific technique. But what I do and what I teach has been very informed by SOT. You know, it was a very important part of my postgraduate upbringing, really.
So if you don't mind me asking, what's the, you know, if you can, what would be your definition of chiropractic? I know there's only one definition of chiropractic, don't get me wrong, but everyone's got their own way of working, and I'm just interested in how.
I mean, chiropractic, you know, listen, what the in my opinion, chiropractic, you know, if there are 100,000 chiropractors in the world, there's going to be 100,000 variations of a theme. And that's because chiropractic is an art. You and I might write exactly the same listing and arguably do exactly the same technique if we did, but we would achieve different results. And the reason is it's an art form. It's like your handwriting and it's like drawing a picture. We can all use the same style, we can all use the same words, but actually it looks different when it's on paper. And so the chiropractic adjustment is an art form. But you asked, what is chiropractic? And simply put, chiropractic is a philosophy of how to approach health and life that incorporates a very heavy slant on the nervous system and on the spine in particular. But in the key point there is that chiropractic is a philosophy. It's not a healing approach, in my opinion, that has a philosophy. It is a philosophy. And we can break that down. We just live that philosophy of holism. The body is a whole, that the body is connected, that we are energetically interconnected with everything else that is made of energy, and that's everything in the universe, really. And principle to that is our nervous system, how we sense the world inside us and how we sense our outside world. We sense our outside world through the five named senses, I mean, your sight, smell, taste, touch, and hearing, but we sense our inner world through our nervous system. And we have senses which are very familiar to chiropractors, but not necessarily so familiar to lay people, such as proprioception, vibration, sense of heat, sense of vibration, and so on. So, you know, we have so many senses which constantly inform our brain. And chiropractic really is about making sure that that system, about how our brain controls our body, functions as well as it can. And in essence, that's chiropractic to me.
No, that's a very informative definition. I'm always interested when I'm doing this. I feel very fortunate to be to sit in a position where I'm listening the same as the listeners are, the other chiropractors, etc. But also some clients are interested in this podcast as well, because it gives them an opportunity to learn, have a better understanding of what a chiropractor is and what they're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. But I think this is really. When I first started doing these podcasts, it was ideally I was hoping to have a podcast with lots of different chiropractors on who we look at as being legends, obviously like yourself, whose names get thrown around left, right, and center. You know, this is going on, this is going on, and you think, well, I don't know where to go first because so many people I want to associate with and mix with and learn from. But this is... I find myself, this is an education in itself, you know, speaking to people like yourself. What made
I'm very humbled, actually. I think of myself as just a fairly sweaty 50-year-old man. It's very humbled that you say that.
You don't look 50 years old. I look 50 years old. You don't look 50 years old, Fran. I need some more adjustment. What made you move to Scotland? Was it your wife?
I got captured, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, well, we met and married while I was still a soldier. And then, well, we elected to leave. We were going to leave. We were going to leave the army. We made our decision to leave in 2004. I say we, it was the two of us, because, but I had, before I left, we had to really make sure that we were going to have a secure world to come back into. I don't mean that we had a house and that sort of stuff, just somewhere we were going to be able to earn a living and support our family, which we didn't have at the time, but we now do have three children. But we made the decision in February 2004 that I was going to leave the army. And serendipitously, that night that I made that decision, my great mentor and friend, Dr. John Howitt, who's a very famous SOT chiropractor, which is how I ended up going down that route, phoned me, and he'd been very influential in my childhood and he has been very influential in most of my life hitherto, actually. Phoned me that night and just sort of questioned me, and by the end of the conversation, I decided I was going to leave the army and going to be a chiropractor. This is back in 2004. We had dial-up internet. You know, we finished the phone call because you couldn't be on the internet and the phone at the same time, and spent the rest of the night looking at chiropractic colleges, Palmer and the like. And I made a decision that we were going to go to Palmer. So that very night, we sent off our application, and then about 4 weeks later, I found myself being called up to go to Iraq, which I was absolutely delighted to do because I was pretty miserable in my desk job at the time as a staff officer in a brigade headquarters in Katrick. And I don't want to get into the politics of Iraq, but going to war, going on an operation, is a little bit like being a sportsman or woman your whole life and turning up to training twice a week and never getting a game. So when you actually go and get to do what you've spent your whole life preparing to do, it's quite a real thing. That's about as much as I really want to say about Iraq. But anyway, I spent the whole time I was in Iraq in conversation with Palmer and working out my plan, how I was going to borrow money and how I was going to do it. And came back, and our son was born about 3 weeks later, and I resigned the next day. And it took me about 9 months to actually get us physically into America as a family. And although I had a degree, which I got through the army in, excuse me, in computer programming, believe it or not, I struggled to load an app on my phone. But I have a first-class degree in information systems management. despite having a degree and some pretty good A-levels, Palmer made me go through a prerequisite process, which I did at their local community college, a bit like a local county college here. I managed to get my equivalent of a high school qualification inside 5 months, which I was quite pleased about.
Wow, that's fast.
Well, it's very spoon fed. I don't want to make myself look any more intelligent. It was made very simple for you. It was a nice segue between military and going to university. So by the time I went to Palmer, I'd actually been studying for, like I say, about 4 or 5 months. So going after, 14 years or 15 years after I left school, it wasn't like going straight into university out of nothing. I was already, my brain was already sort of accelerating. So I really enjoyed Palmer, actually.
Do you have any memories of the lecturers or the things that really made a difference to you?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. No, I love Palmer. I actually love learning. I think anybody who doesn't like learning really is going to have a fairly boring life. It doesn't mean that you have to learn through academia. Life is just a constant journey of learning. And I think, if you could make a lot of money being a student, I'd have hundreds of degrees by now. I loved it. I loved being in that. I mean, for coming out of the army, for me, it was great actually going into the structure of a program where you knew you had to be at 9 o'clock every day. Actually, Palmer is quite interesting. BJ Palmer had this great philosophy of life that you function better in the morning. So Palmer still to this day starts at 7:30 in the morning. I think it must be one of the only universities in the world where everybody is at work for 7:30 in the morning. I loved it, but in particular, great lecturers. The real jewel of the crown in the crown, sorry, beg your pardon, of Palmer when I was there was the technique department. The core curriculum was Gonstead, Thompson, Toggle, upper cervical, including a little bit of knee chest. I think that was about it for technique, but we did loads of electives. I did electives and activator technique, atlas orthogonal, which is an upper cervical specific. I did electives in SOT, Gonstead. So basically, I left there with a very broad education, about four or five, well, I'm talking about seven or eight techniques, actually, which I still use all of today, you know. And I may not use Atlas Orthogonal, but I still use some of the thought processes behind it, if that makes sense. Whilst I didn't appreciate it at the time, I'm very glad I went to Palmer, as the general, the osmotic, you can't go to Palmer and not sort of imbibe through osmosis or otherwise the philosophy and the history of the place and how chiropractic evolved and how important it is. And most importantly, understanding the signature of chiropractic, which is the chiropractic adjustment. And really, I think it's very important that we hold on to that thing. I agree with Dr. Fred Barge, who's a great, he died not long before I started, actually. But he's a great hero of mine subsequently, that, you know, if we're not unique, we will have no reason to exist. And if we start to resemble and merge and imitate physiotherapy and osteopathy and any, you know, and acupuncture and all the other healing arts that many of people within our profession do, there will be no reason for a separate and distinct profession. And I put a hell of a lot of energy, of my own energy, into reinforcing that. I suppose that can segue into what, you know, why reinforce something so strongly. And the answer is I deliver a lot of chiropractic adjustments every week. And I know with extreme certainty that every single person who walks out of my adjusting space is at ease. Their body is at a state of ease. And at a state of ease, the brain, the central nervous system, and the innate intelligence that we're all imbued with is capable of an infinitesimal amount of improved function and health and expression within our body. And I don't need to massage anything, and I don't need to do muscle work, and I don't need to stick needles in, because actually the adjustment does it all. Does everybody achieve the same results through a chiropractic adjustment? The answer is no. It's an art form. And we all get better and better. And I would hate anybody, I would hate to think I hadn't evolved, because I actually look back at only 2 years ago. And whilst I was getting great results 2 years ago, I look back and think, God, I've come so far in this 2 years. How the hell did anybody get better 2 years ago? But they do. And I've managed to get more certain, better results. I've managed to get faster at identifying the problem, which chiropractors call a subluxation, and we'll go into that in a minute. And exponentially exploded my results and the effect that I have on humanity.
No, absolutely. So do you mind talking to me about in more detail about the adjustments and about why we do the adjustment in certain areas? You know, how do you find your area? I'm only asking the question because some people might be listening to this who might want to know a little bit of the basics of what we're looking to do when we have a spine in front of us, a nervous system in front of us.
So honestly and truly, the chiropractic adjustment is, I'm going to use modern words, but by adjusting the spine, we effectively hack into the nervous system. We move immovable spaces, immovable joints, which we call vertebral subluxations. As a cranial chiropractor, I want to say that subluxations can occur both in the cranium, the spine, and the pelvis. And I also do adjust extremities with an intention of improving the nervous system. You could put five chiropractors in a room and ask them what a subluxation is, and you'd have murder if you put a knife in the middle of it, because we all disagree. But one thing that is certain, and that every single human being, animal, mammal, tree, every living entity on this planet has to adapt to stress. And you then argue, you say, sorry, you then next question should be, well, what is stress? And I'm going to say, simply put, stress is anything that we have to adapt to. We often talk in chiropractic language, or the lingua franca of our profession, it being about thoughts, traumas, and toxins, or emotional, physical, and chemical. And that's true. Too much of anything physical, chemical, and emotional will become stressful to our system and cause us to adapt. When we do that, our spine, cranium, and pelvis changes as the nervous system adapts. And I'm going to state something, and then if need be, I'll defend it. But every subluxation starts as a perfect adaptation to stress. So let's just go through that, as I tell it as a story. I'm going to pick on T8, because the sympathetic sensory fibers that come out of T8 are very important for the organ, the liver. I have a drink of red wine tonight, and that is fine. It's a very small amount of good and bad, and my intelligent nervous system and digestive system will cope with that very easily. But I decide tonight, actually, I'm going to have a bottle and a half of red wine. And that's actually a very heavy toxic load that's going to cause my brain and body to have to adapt quite a lot. If I don't drink again for a while, my intelligent adaptive system will probably cope with that. We'll get through the toxic load by cleaning up our blood through our liver. Our brain will eventually come back to normal, and we'll start to function as a normal human being. But if I repeat that stressful load 20 days on a row, actually what we're going to have is we're going to have what's the beginning of a permanent adaptation. And this will change things in our brain, and it will change things in our spine. And how that does that is open to question, but I personally believe that the autonomic nervous system, which we always talk about as the motor effect, we talk about the fight or flight and how the sympathetic motor affects our eyes, our breathing, our heart, and our organs. And we talk about how the parasympathetic, or colloquially termed the rest, repair, and digest effects, is the opposite and reduces our, dilates our pupils, and slows our heart rate down, and constricts our bronchi, and kickstarts our viscera, and how those two work. But we talk about those as motor functions, but 80% of the autonomic nervous system, I beg your pardon, is sensory. And every time alarm cells are sent from any organ, they are sent up both parasympathetic, principally our vagus nerve, and sympathetic, which goes to our spine. And when that happens, there is an adaptive response in both areas, namely up in the vagus nerve goes through a little hole in the bottom of your skull called your jugular foramen. And the other parasympathetic nerves that affect us, principally in the body, go into our sacrum, S2, 3, and 4, for those of you who can't remember that. And the sympathetics go to, there's a sympathetic chain ganglion at every vertebral level. So there is a sensory sympathetic that goes to each of our vertebral levels. And as our body adapts to all of those stresses, there is an adaptive response which we can palpate in our spine. If you think about areas of our body, such as our pelvis, too many of us think of chiropractic as bones and muscles. There are no muscles which cross the sacroiliac joint, and yet it is very strong, very adaptive joint with no muscles that cross it. And yet anybody who's ever adjusted one realizes it can be fixed, or in chiropractic lingua franca, subluxated. Well, what's subluxating there? And it's the contractile ability of connective tissue. So our body adapts to stress. Where is the subluxation? I'm going to be slightly controversial here. I'll expect lots of hate mail from some people. And some people would say that the subluxation is what we palpate. I can feel that C5 is not moving. That's the subluxation. And I agree, that's what we palpate. But is that where the nervous interference is? And I'm going to state that as C5 stops moving for whatever reason, usually an adaptation to some form of stress, either physical, mental, chemical, or a combination of all three. But actually what changes is the brain. And the brain is, if C5 is not working, then all of the communication from and to C5 starts to diminish. And the way neural contamination happens is not only does the communication to and from C5 diminish, but all of the communication associated with C5. Sorry, I think I got my C's and T's mixed up there. So you end up with distal problems, i.e. everything associated and through C5. So you would end up with problems in your deltoid and your biceps and potentially your diaphragm and so on and so forth. So if we understand that the body, the brain and nervous system adapts to stress in a particular way, the parasympathetic is up into our head and into our sacrum and to our bottom, and the sympathetic is all our spine, we can actually therefore undo the subluxation, understanding that. So if somebody is struggling and they want a really simple way of achieving stunning results really quickly, adjust the cervical spine and adjust the pelvis and stimulate some cerebrospinal fluid, the easiest way is through the sacrum. And if you just did that and it took you 60 seconds, you will absolutely turbocharge your results. And my seminar that I teach, which I call Brain-Based Chiropractic, goes into that in a lot of detail over 12 hours, namely how our nervous system adapts to stress, how it changes our spine, cranium, and pelvis, and how if we can understand how every single person in the world subluxates in a predictable way, we can unsubluxate them in a predictable way, making chiropractic incredibly simple.
Wow, so beautifully put. Well, I'm just glad I'm doing your course in Liverpool. Am I right in saying that you came back from Spain? Was it Spain not so long ago?
Yeah, I did. Well, I was in Spain 5 weeks ago. I wasn't teaching there. That was me going to actually learn. I was in Hamburg teaching. I'm teaching in Spain on the 14th, 15th of September. I've got the course in Liverpool, and I've got one in Essex, just went live today. And that's on the 21st of April. The one you're doing is on the 4th of May. And I've got a higher level one for people who've done my course already on the 1st and 2nd of June in London. But really, unless you've done the first course, it's a little bit too much information to the second one. You can still go on and you'll still get information, but there's no, you need to learn what the letters mean before you start typing on a typewriter, if you know.
No, absolutely. So I'm fortunate. I can book myself onto the one in London. You said it was in June?
Yeah, I think it's the first, second of June. It's the first weekend of June anyway. I have a lovely friend there called Russ. He's actually a trained osteopath, but don't let any levels of judgment get in the way. He's a brilliant chiropractor. He practices chiropractic, but he does so with his osteopathic license. Basically, he's brilliant as well. So he's hosting us down in London there. And in April, we're in Essex. There's a lovely family, Stefan Gospod. I'm going to murder his name, Gospodinov, and his wife Abby Gospodinova are hosting us in Essex. We're with Alex Eatley, and you're going to see us in Liverpool on the 4th of May. And then we're in Hamburg again in November. We're going to go to Northern Ireland, hopefully in October. And I'm a father and I'm a husband, and my principal responsibility is to my family and then my patients. So the teaching at the moment, whilst I still have children of school going age, sort of plays slightly second fiddle to that. But within a couple of years, I'll probably be doing, you know, as many as 10 to 15 or even more weekends a year. But I just don't want to miss the kids' rugby matches and stuff like that.
Well, what do you call your courses?
Well, I call it brain-based chiropractic. I can't think of a better one. I tried. I like running, and I've spent hundreds of hours running trying to think of a better one. And the reason I call it brain-based is because as I stated in my previous, every adaptation that we make to stress is basically an adaptation of our nervous system and our brain. And we might palpate a non-functioning T7, but actually both the effect of that non-function is in the brain, and the adaptive response that we put into it, as in through the adjustment, affects the brain. So if you think about it, what we might think we're moving bones and changing muscles, but what we're really doing is changing how the brain understands our body and processes it. And you know, I could go and cut your arms and your legs off, and it wouldn't be a nice thing to do, but you would still be Alan Walker, because you are, in effect, your nervous system. A little bit, slightly, just taking that a little bit further, I think, and as I'll show you when we meet on the 4th of May, we cannot ignore the metaphysical in this. And it's quite easy to explain through science. You don't have to be, when I went, just to segue slightly away, when I went to Palmer College, and sorry, those are my six dogs outside. When I went to Palmer College in 2005, I had been in Iraq, and I left Iraq spiritually very different to when I arrived. It was quite a traumatic space, as you might imagine. And I had decided that I was an atheist. So I went to Palmer, this very, the modern word is vitalistic, but BJ would never have heard or used that word. College, and yet I was an extremely atheist, and actually devoid of any sort of spiritual content. Whereas now I wouldn't describe myself as religious, but I would describe myself as very connected. And regardless of whatever art or technique you use, unless you really, really connect with somebody, you're just a mechanic. When you connect on a different level, you will find that your results are turbocharged. It's almost like kryptonite to Superman. It's very difficult to explain. And I would say that's probably my most modern evolution as an evolving chiropractor, is to spend a lot of my time getting super, super connected and present with every patient. And in doing so, my adjustments are actually able to be very short, but yet achieve twice as much as I used to do in 10 minutes or even longer in the past. I think that answers your question.
Yeah, but there's something else. Well, lots of things I want to ask you. We're going to run out of time, but you spoke about your osteopath friend who. I guess if I was to meet him, I would think he was a chiropractor, because I guess what's made him a chiropractor is the philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we chiropractors, I think the greatest problem in our profession is judgment. All chiropractic works. I don't think it all works the same, but it all works. And we become very tribal around the groups that we coalesce around. And whether you do McTominay, which I love, whether you do SOT, whether you do my brain-based approach, whether you do diversified, it all is going to work on some level. And actually, your technique really is going to speak volumes about you And rather than it not working, it's just going to attract the type of patients that will like what you do. That's me just saying, we as chiropractors really got to stop judging each other. It really, you know, I find it a little bit irritating on Facebook. And somebody of a certain tribe says, where's people of my tribe? You know, the only people who can fix this person are in my tribe. It's not true at all. You know, there are great chiropractors everywhere who can do great things. Yeah, I think that, you know, my friend Russ is a great health practitioner. And he practices an art form, depending on your background. If you're coming with a medical mind, you might call it a manipulation. If you're coming from as a physiotherapist, you might call it a manipulation. If you're a chiropractor, you call it an adjustment. And he can move a bone really well. And he also centers in and around the spine.
This is the osteopath.
This is my osteopathic friend, yeah. But his philosophical understanding that the body is a self-healing, self-regulating organism, and that central to healing is a properly functioning nervous system is a very uniquely chiropractic approach. And that's the approach he uses in a magnificent way. Although to practice legally, he's called an osteopath. But in my mind, the chiropractic is the signature approach of the nervous system, the adjustment, subluxation. And those are unique to us. And if we don't keep them unique, there won't be any reason for us to be a separate and distinct profession in one or two generations' time.
So it seems a bit of a strange thing for me to sort of bring up when you've covered it lots of different times through it. But do you mind just explaining the definition of a subluxation, an inhibition? Some people call it. What does that mean to you for listeners who don't understand that?
Okay, so if you were reading a chiropractic green book, say the 1927 book by Stevenson, which is really foundational for all chiropractic philosophy, he will say that a subluxation is when one vertebra has lost its proper juxtaposition with the vertebra next to it. And I can't remember the rest of the exact definition, you know, thus impinging on a nerve. And that was really thinking about neurology and function in 1927, but it's not untrue. What we palpate when we feel the spine is one vertebra that is not moving against another vertebra, the cranium or pelvis, in my personal opinion. But really what I think of as subluxation is where we can find the physical manifestation of how your body and nervous system have adapted to stress. And what happens is, as we adapt to stress, is our brain and our nervous system start to close various areas down, such as a vertebral segment or otherwise. And when we get that moving properly and improve neurological function, then we undo that subluxation effect. So subluxation, put simply, and without giving it any geography, is something whereby the nervous system is not functioning properly within the body that we can change and remove to improve nervous system function.
Brilliant. Thank you for going over that for people that might need to know more about what we're trying to achieve, what we're looking for, and how we're looking to make a change that's going to actually help with the nervous system. Going over the sort of origins, you were speaking a little bit about the origins of osteopathy. Yeah. Do you mind just going over that again for me?
Well, osteopathy was founded by a man with the surname Still, and he was in, I believe, in Missouri. In modern driving times, probably only about 7 hours away from Davenport, but in the late 1800s in the Midwest of America, it was probably a few days' ride actually. But whether Still or Palmer ever knew each other, Still developed osteopathy, and his basic premise was blood flow. And then he started to work on the spine to improve what he thought was blood flow. And, you know, osteopaths have been very successful in how they've developed. Our genesis as chiropractors started when D.D. Palmer in 1895 adjusted a man called Harvey Lillard, and his hearing came back. And I've had many people who've had massive improvements in their sensory function as a result of chiropractic, so I can truly believe that it happened. D.D. Palmer is my hero, actually, in how he understood the world, not the fact that he had four wives and various other ways he lived his life, but how a man who was relatively uneducated by modern standards understood so much about how we adapt to the world. And, you know, his basic premise was that you have two men both working at the same bench, exposed to the same food, the same air, same environment, yet one gets sick and the other doesn't. So it can't be just the fact that they're exposed to the germs, because you and I are carrying around about 2 kilos of germs at any one time in our body. It's not the fact that the germs are there, it's the fact that their body couldn't adapt to the fact they're there. And so Didi was way, way, way ahead of his time. And he also, you know, understood, because he came out of a sort of a philosophical line of thinking, in the connection of the body energetically with the interconnection with the rest of the world. Now, I fought this like crazy when I was at Palmer. Even for the first 5 or 6 years while I was graduated, after I graduated, I thought people like me were bloody nutters. You know, I was practicing in a very judgmental, mechanistic, and I use the word mechanistic as a mechanic. You know, I'm fixing parts rather than removing the interference and allowing the body to heal as weak. And just to say that, you know, if you take away the handbrake, you cannot stop the body from healing. Yeah, think of any cut or wound on your body. It will not stop trying to heal. You'd have to keep cutting it. In fact, if you have open heart surgery or any abdominal surgery, one of the challenges they have is that the body's trying to heal itself the whole time you're in there. So, you know, it's fundamentally D.D. Palmer was a very, very, I don't know, very clever, connected guy. You know, who knows, if he made his discoveries in the 20th century, he might have gone on to win great prizes and great acclaim.
Absolutely. I don't doubt that for a moment. In fact, we at times like we're living in at the moment, I think we need a lot more thinkers like that for sure, in all elements of science. Can I all of this philosophy has come through so many times during this conversation, and I know that the you were involved in and building a book with other chiropractors. Could you explain something about that?
So I am very emotionally involved in the Scotland College of Chiropractic, founded by a very dear friend of mine, Ross McDonald. And my daughter has just been offered a conditional place there. So I'm connected in all sorts of ways and very invested in its success long term. It came to me, and then we had lockdown, that I couldn't give tens of thousands of pounds to the college personally. I need too much of my own income to live and pay for children's university and schooling and stuff. But I was sitting in a seminar, a really wonderful seminar called the Edinburgh Lectures, and everybody was dropping pearls of wisdom, little pearls of wisdom, little pearls of wisdom. And I thought, what if we got a whole bunch of pearls of wisdom, like mini seminars, into a book that were written in about 1500 words, which is about a 10 to 15 minute read, a single bedtime read or a single toilet read or whatever you want to put it. And it didn't have to be a deep green book, but at the end of reading all of these little bits, you would have a much broader, deeper understanding of chiropractic as a science and an art and a philosophy. And in some cases, like me and you, we're business owners. That's a whole different learning that we never get at university. And so we produced this book. Then we had lockdown. wrote to a bunch of people who had a little bit of time on their hands, or I hope they did, and asked them to produce their 1500 words. And what we got really was an absolute diamond. Some really big names in the profession who are in the book tell me that it's one of their favorite books because they don't have to start at the beginning and read at the end. They can just constantly dip back in into chapters that resonated with them, chapters that challenged them. We call it the Wisdom of 33, and we're actually just about to produce a version of a sequel. And the second time round, we've learned so many lessons from the first time. I think it'll be even better. But I'm just sort of trying to get the energy ready because producing the first book was so energy sapping, trying to coalesce 66 chiropractors into writing an article and getting it printed and published and everything was quite a big job. So before we embark on this next project, I just need to make sure we're ready for it. Because I think, you know, there's been a huge increase in the amount of literature out there since lockdown in particular. But what we want to do is make something that's really meaningful and will be financially contributing to the Scotland College. And why do I think the Scotland College is important? I keep going back to the fact that if we're not unique, there will be no reason for us in just a couple of generations' time. And anybody who doesn't tap into that uniqueness is really missing something. You know, the results that we get through the delivery of a chiropractic adjustment are extraordinary. And if I was imitating anybody else, I just wouldn't get those results. If I was massaging, and if I was sticking needles in, and if I was doing anything that isn't chiropractic, I simply would not get those astonishing results. And I know there are so many people in our profession who never find it for all sorts of reasons. One, several of our colleges actively teach against chiropractic, which is a real tragedy. I don't know where they think we're going to be in 40 years' time. And two, it takes a lot of courage to go and be different. I think many of us innately crave orthodoxy. We would love the orthodoxy of the medical profession to put their arms around us and give us a great big cuddle and say, "You're all right, mate, you're just like us." And we're never going to get it. If we're ever included within medicine, we're only going to be a subset of the physiotherapy department. I think people really need to realize that. We'll not be unique, and we will just be, you know, a spinal department in the physiotherapy department. Yeah, let's be under no illusions what acceptance within orthodox means. I used to be an army officer, and it took me actually to become a chiropractor to be a rebel, to think outside the box, to challenge conventional wisdom. You know, and as I say to almost all my patients, you've been trying that system for a while, and where's it got you? And I'll say, "Well, it's got me, you know, I'm still sick." I said, "Well, will you try something else?" And that's become a real philosophy of my own for life. You know, let's constantly push boundaries. If the door is closed, ask why. If somebody says do something, ask why. Never jump up and say yes just because somebody you assume to be an authority or greater says that something's right or wrong. So I've become quite challenging to authority, I think. But I think in a very good way for the benefit of my patients and hopefully for the development of our profession.
Oh, do you know what, Donald? I'm so pleased that we had you on, and I've been making notes as well. So I hope that we could have you on again in the future. What I'm interested in doing is to if you will come back on again after I've done the second course, because then I'd like to communicate with you over, you know, how I saw the course and what difference it's made to my clients and how it's changed the way that I think about chiropractic. But this has been very informative. I mean, I've been looking at two podcasts recently with Tim Young and Tim Shorb. I've got another one coming up very shortly with Dr. Bobby in America, who's still working now in the 70s, charitably dealing with children with specialist needs. and very successfully. And that's so I'm getting around some really amazing people, trying to pull out the best of the people they was teaching, the people who have got something to teach to students, to graduates, to and to chiropractors who've been, who don't always get the opportunity to get around you guys. But this has been amazing, and thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much, Donald.
I'm very humbled and grateful. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in the next 7 weeks, something like that. Thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate you. Thank you, Donald.
Take care, Alfred. Bye-bye.